Welcome to River Cafe Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
I've done so many things that had very tight corsets. You can't have lunch. You'd make you sick. When I was doing 101, 102 Dalmatians, I had a corset that made my waist 21 inches.
Wow.
And if it was off by a quarter of an inch, you literally could faint.
I'm here with my wonderful friend, Glenn Close. Sadly, we're far apart. She's in Montana. I'm in London. But we're both going to go together to Genoa in Liguria, where this recipe for tagliatelle with walnut sauce comes from.
300 grams tagliatelle, 2 kilos fresh, wet walnuts, shelled, bitter skins removed. 100 grams breadcrumbs soaked in milk. 2 garlic cloves peeled. 150 milligrams olive oil. 100 grams Parmesan grated. 4 tablespoons fresh basil. 75 grams unsalted butter. This is best made in a pestle and mortar. Pound the walnuts and garlic until combined and season well. Squeeze most of the milk from the breadcrumbs, then add to the mortar and mix together. Pour in the olive oil gradually. Finally, add half the Parmesan and basil. If it is too thick, add more milk. Cook the tagliatelle, drain, and return to the saucepan. Add the softened butter and toss. Gently stir in the sauce and serve with the remaining Parmesan. Oh, and my mouth is watering.
And mine is too. So beautiful the way you read it. It makes me want to eat it and cook it right away. I love this recipe because it's so regional. It comes from Genoa. It is totally seasonal, and you only eat it when the walnuts are fresh, which is in the early months of autumn. And there's something very delicate and very subtle about the taste. Why did you choose this recipe, Glenn?
Well, I chose it because I asked my wonderful daughter, Annie, what recipe she would choose from the River Cafe. And without hesitation, she said, tagliatelle with walnut sauce. So I chose it because I love my daughter and she is a foodie of the first order.
She is. And did you always cook with her? Did you cook together? Was she somebody who loved food from the beginning?
Yes. I have a picture of Annie where she barely could reach, the kitchen counter. And she used to come in and say, I want to cook something. And she would just get a bowl and start putting things in a bowl. And you'd say, do you want to add a little milk?
Yeah.
Or yeah. So she's always had a penchant for cooking. And I can't say that I have. So I am really, really overjoyed when she comes and visits because I know I'm going to have a spate of fabulous meals.
Yeah.
And she's very adventurous. She likes to try new things.
When you were growing up, who cooked for you? What was the cooking like in your childhood?
It was hilarious. My early childhood, my mom, she would open a can of succotash, which had those mealy lima beans. Hated it. Hated succotash. And corned beef hash. I remember she did some wonderful ribs, though, but I think she just put ketchup and mustard together and put them over, but they were really good. I remember that from my childhood. But I think she was a basic, just a good steak or chicken. We had a rooster called Pretzel, and he would crow during the night. And my brother cut a oil drum in half and cleaned it out. And at night, Pretzel would be put under the oil drum, but you still could hear him going, oh. Finally, everybody thought it was time for Pretzel to be butchered, and he was, and he was put in the freezer. And then I happened to be there when they brought Pretzel out and said, let's roast Pretzel. And he was inedible. You couldn't even get a knife into him. I thought it was Pretzel's revenge.
That's so funny. And what about, apart from being in the kitchen and being home, what about restaurants? Do you like restaurants?
Pre-COVID?
Yeah, pre-COVID.
I love going to restaurants. I love sitting down, knowing that you're going to get a wonderful meal. But I think for me, the most important thing about a restaurant is its atmosphere and who you actually are there with. The last time I was in the River Cafe was with Jonathan Price and Kate, his wife, and you were there and you came and sat and you were busy around, but we were celebrating the end of filming The Wife. But it was such a spectacular time because you feel so embraced by the whole atmosphere. And also then, of course, there's nothing more wonderful and brings people together than when a gorgeous plate of food is put in front of you.
It's always interested me the way that you can see that people come sometimes to a restaurant and they are a bit damaged, or they're a bit tender, or they're a bit tired, or they're a bit sad, or they're very happy, or they're celebrating. There's a lot going on. And I also think that's why perhaps actors really do like restaurants, because there is a theatrical atmosphere, do you think, of a restaurant?
Very much so. And I think as an actor, there's something wonderful about knowing the people in a place and coming in, and you literally feel like you're going into another version of home. Mm. And I think that's also important. But it's interesting that you say that, because I was recently in California and I was staying in Pasadena at a very lovely hotel. One evening when I went with my book and get a little bit of dinner, across from me at a two table was a couple, and the guy was sobbing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, sobbing out loud. And I wanted to go and say, I'm so sorry. But, a woman was holding his hand. And it went on for quite a while. Wow. And then he would pull himself together and start laughing. And I thought, of course, my actor's imagination, I thought, what has happened? What is that situation? But I found it fascinating that much emotion was being, let out in a very public place. Mm. As far as observing how people eat, one of my ex-partners, I remember the day when I actually noticed how he chewed, and he chewed like Bugs Bunny, like really fast. And it was like, it would be a scene out of a comedy that I just stared and I thought, I can't believe that I'm with somebody who eats like that. And it was so funny and so distinctive that when I was in Mars Attacks and playing the first lady to Jack Nicholson's president, and we're eating TV dinners in front of the TV, I chew like that. It's a total, I totally took how my ex chewed, because it was, it was astonishing.
I get it. I relate to that. I have a friend that left her husband because of the way he buttered bread. She just couldn't believe that he made all these. He was so mean. She said they were making garlic bread, and he was so stingy about everything in life. And then she just saw him put the smallest amount of butter on a piece of bread, and she thought, that's it. It's a bit like you and the chewing. I cannot. This is it. I just can't do this anymore.
Yeah. This is it. It kind of was a this is it moment for me. Yeah.
Back to Annie and you. Do you eat out together, now that she's older and she's married and you're not maybe cooking together, making pancakes for her? Do you share a lot of food together? Do you eat out, or does she cook for you?
She does. And the thing that amazes me is how much she loves it, how much she takes time in getting the right ingredients. And I think the help she likes the most is the cleanup. She doesn't like people hovering. It's really a process for her that I think is psychological as well as practical. I think she finds real solace, and she has told me that it's a place that helps her with anxiety. You just get in the kitchen.
Yeah, it's comforting, and it's a connection, isn't it? It is comforting. And our connection was, we met in Mexico. And I was thinking how many meals we shared in Mexico. and going to Contramar and sitting there for hours with our friends.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And going to that breakfast place and having breakfast and having margaritas.
Oh, wasn't that fun?
Remember that beautiful.
Contramar, that was, God, what a great place. Yeah. I think fine Mexican cuisine is, besides Italian, my favorite food ever. Mm. You know, if you have a beautifully cooked chicken with one of those dark mole sauces, it's just exquisite. The ingredients that they put in is so beautifully subtle and deep, you know. It's, you know, I put salt and pepper and Lowry sauce on my roast chicken. You know, it's like, but it informs you because probably you're getting stimulated in your taste buds in different places, and it actually becomes almost a kind of a physical experience. It's profound when you sit down to a beautifully cooked meal with complex ingredients. And the breakfasts, certainly in Zicatela, is the avocado, the wonderful fresh fruit, and also the eggs, you know, just to me, my favorite was that moment of breakfast, and you could hear the ocean pounding, and I really miss it. I really want to go back.
Well, we will. We have to go. We were in Mexico, I think most recent time we were in Mexico together, it was your birthday. And I remember we were in this incredibly beautiful, rather remote place. And Chris Terrio, your friend, and I thought we had to get you a birthday cake. And we walked down the beach. We came to this little village. We thought we're going to find this really wonderful Mexican birthday cake for you. And in fact, we went into this kind of pastry shop, and they had those kind of terrible looking, slightly plastic birthday cakes that were kind of full of sugar and kind of probably fake icing, but it was all we could get. And so we bought it, and we came back and we brought it out to you for your birthday. And it turned out to be like the most delicious thing that we had ever had. Do you remember? We were so shocked that here we were in Mexico eating this kind of who knows what cake, and it was so good. I think the three of us finished the whole birthday cake.
Yeah. In France, when I did Dangerous Liaisons, they have French hours, which don't have a break, and you go and get something when they're doing a setup or something. But then they had a dining room trailer with tables with white tablecloths and wine on the tables. Like, what? And then, of course, you have caterers and you have the craft service table where everybody goes and snacks. And that really depends on how much money the production has as what the quality of that is. But I did a film up in Canada in January, and they had a lot of really healthy food. That was really nice to have because you can just gain weight.
I was thinking about Big Chill and the memories. There's so many memories from the Big Chill, but a lot of the Big Chill, or it seems to me in my memory, because I haven't watched it for a while, takes place in the kitchen, doesn't it? Sitting around the table.
Yeah.
There's a lot of food in that movie. What was it like making that movie and the food and the talking?
I can't remember what we ate. I do remember because it was my second movie. Mm. And I was shown what the pattern of my china would be. And I said, oh, I would never have that. I would never have that. And I got all upset. And then Larry Kasdan was very, you know, said, yeah, thank you, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then, of course, when you see the movie, there's no way that anyone would ever notice the pattern on the china. So I realized how gracious Larry Kasdan was. I think in The Big Chill, wasn't there a bit about throwing spaghetti against the refrigerator? See if it was. But yeah, I think there's something that promotes conversation when you're sitting around a table. And that movie is all about conversation. And, you know, in life, we all end up in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So I think it was very true to life that a lot of the scenes take place in the kitchen.
But what is it like being as a political you know, my most socially conscious, political, involved activist friend. Do you feel that way about food? I mean, and farming? Are you, you know, you're in Montana. What is that like?
Yeah, I mean, doesn't it all come down to soil? Mm-hmm. This valley, the Gallatin Valley, it's just vast and spectacular. And it has some of the best soil in North America. But it also has sprawl. And all I can think of is we're building over some of the best soil that could be feeding people. The least there should be is a tax for developers who are taking away the ability for produce to be grown on this invaluable soil. Annie wants to develop a garden out on our property, and we have a wonderful, wonderful place for that. And she wants to eventually find students with the agricultural department, you know, to use whatever, in whatever way we can to develop things. She loves the Stone Barn thing, the things that they're doing at Stone Barn, where they're developing vegetables that have very wonderful flavor, but they take less water. Things like that, I think, are going to be crucial as, you know, our population keeps expanding and our water supply keeps diminishing. I think, especially in a place like this, we're always afraid of fire now in the summers. Mm-hmm. It's just a way of life now. Mm-hmm. You have to think of water, and you have to think what's the best way to produce food. And I can't say I'm deep into that. I think there are people here that are, and I can learn from them. But yeah, it's definitely an issue that's not, you know, obviously not here. It's worldwide. Populations are shifting because of food supply and depleted soils. Yeah. I mean, that's...
Well, we hope we have a... history we have that's a, happened. As an American in London, but as an American in America, we do have a government now, it seems, you know, the Department of Agriculture and our president and the internal affairs are all really thinking much more in that, I think, that way. It's just, it's, everyone has to now and wants to. It's sustainability.
Oh, God, it's a profound relief because the heads of all those departments were formerly people who had worked to dismantle them at terrible cost. Yeah. For future generations. Terrible cost. You know, I have no words for what I feel about people who don't think of their children and grandchildren as they're raping, you know, our natural resources. It's, you know, shameful.
So we think about our, as you say, our children and our grandchildren, and you think about your daughter and you talk about, you know, you're in Montana and I'm in London, and so food is a connection, but it also is a comfort. So I try to end each conversation with the question, if food is a comfort, do you have one comfort food? Do you have a comfort food that you would go to when you need that?
My unhealthy comfort food would be coffee, ice cream, and Oreos. I've had a passion for Oreos ever since I was tiny.
Do you separate them? Or do you take the top off?
You have to. Everybody has their way of eating Oreos. I very carefully try to take off the top with my bottom teeth. You know, you feel like you've accomplished it if the top comes off in one piece. And then I scrape the lard out with my and I place the chocolate wafers on my tongue as if I was, you know, taking communion. Yeah.
I have to say, we have many things in common, but I eat an Oreo in exactly the same way. That's exactly. Yeah. So there you are. Exactly. The same way. Yeah. Thank you. We'll see each other very soon.
This holiday season, if you can't come to the River Cafe, the River Cafe will come to you. Our beautiful gift boxes are full of ingredients we cook with and design objects we have in our homes. River Cafe olive oil, Tuscan chocolates, Venetian glasses, a Florentine Christmas cake made in our pastry kitchen, and more. We ship them everywhere. To find out more or to place your order, visit shoptherivercafe.co.uk.
River Cafe Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.